session. Very excited to introduce Dr. James Mahan to lead this special session. After Dr. Mahan's presentation, we're going to have a cover crops focus in this special session. But at this point, I'd like to welcome Dr. James Mahan, Senior Physiologist of the Year from 2016, to give a presentation on canopy temperature. What is it good for? Sounds like a song.
So it is a kind of a switch in title, because I was going to present a real short, simple thing, and then Tyson called me and said you can expand your remarks, which is always a dangerous thing to do. I'm going to be looking at my watch, and it's not because I'm bored to be here, but I have this little stopwatch on here that may keep me from having some trouble, and I guess I'm just going to click the button to go forward, right? Okay. A couple of things to add on there is a collaborator on this is Paxton Payton, a physiologist in Lubbock with the ARS, and also a graduate student, Ide Laza, did some of the statistical work for us on this, and I'd like to thank her and also acknowledge that we had some funding from Cotton Incorporated that supported this work. So maybe where we'd start off is that, 30 years ago, canopy temperature measurement was sort of an exotic undertaking, some alchemy involved with it. Today, I think it's becoming a routine measurement that's often included in plant studies, and I think that's probably good. There was this old meme of Richard Nixon in 1988, tanned, rested, and ready. And I think that maybe that's where we've gotten with some of our canopy temperature stuff. It's ready to go. It was complex, expensive, and wired back then. And over that time frame, over my career, that's kind of what infrared thermometer sensors have done. Simpler, smaller, cheaper, easier. That $20 sensor is probably about $5 now, and disposable, we throw them away. But surprisingly, more reliable than the 1985 device that cost 1,000 times more. This is our first infrared thermometry system. We developed this about 2007, and these are kind of nice. They're wireless, and they talk to each other, and they talk to the web. And most importantly, there's a company that commercialized them and sells them, so you could buy one if you wanted. And there's no test or licensing required. They'll just give them to you, and you can do whatever you want. No mafia that you have to join. So we've done a lot of temperature measuring over the years, and one of the questions I get a lot is what do I do with my temperature data? How do I look at it? That sort of thing. And so I thought I would use as an example a little study that we did looking at the effect of cotton leaf shape on the canopy temperature of the crop. And the specific question we had was, does an okra leaf shape enhance cooling under water deficit conditions? And so the idea is that as you break up that leaf area, that leaf shape as compared to a normal, that you have a effective, you reduce the boundary layer, and it gives you better cooling exchanges, and primarily under water deficit conditions is where we think that will come up. So we suggested that the irregular leaf shape will give us some advantages and under some conditions, and certainly would result in lower canopy temperatures than the normal leaf canopy. And so the approach was just to grow those two varieties in the field under a range of irrigation conditions so we could see a range of canopy temperatures, and make those comparisons and see if that helped. And it was pretty simple. We grew them in the field. The normal leaf was a fiber max. The okra was an Altex variety. They're not the same varieties, so there are possibly differences in rooting patterns and water extraction, a variety of other things. But we were primarily interested in the leaf shape effect. We do know that at the end of the season, the yield and quality measurements were very similar for the two varieties. We used four irrigation levels. We had a rain-fed level planted into a decent profile. And then we had 1, 5, 3, and 6 millimeters of irrigation per day applied with a subsurface drip irrigation system. We measured the canopy temperature 15-minute interval for 120 days. We only had one sensor per plot, so not very many sensors. We used the Smart Crop sensor, and the data set consisted of about 90,000 measurements of temperature. So there's a good bit of data there to look at. So when we start collecting data, sort of the first step we always take is to begin to look at the environmental conditions that went along with it. And what we're typically interested in is that top panel is air temperature and dew point temperature. You could put VPD, or relative humidity, there. If you work around Robert Lascano, you put dew point on there because that's the correct number to put. What you can see in the air temperature pattern, and not unusual in Lubbock, Texas, is this abrupt drop in air temperature on September 5th. So you now have a nice hot summer going along there. That line, that black line, is about 30 degrees C. And so you can see on September 5th, all the heat went out of the environment. If you look at 2016 data for Lubbock, Texas, very similar picture, except the heat fell out on August 12th this year. So it sort of shows our high altitude problems with cotton cultivation is that the season can end like a door slamming. The next set is that solar radiation data, and you know it always correlates somewhat with air temperature. And then you can see the rain patterns that we throw in there, kind of to have an idea of what's going on. And you can see a cluster of late season rain events in September in that. Now, the next step that we would use in looking at canopy temperature data is kind of to throw it all into a graphic that is not particularly informational. In each of those instances, we put a reference line at 28 degrees C, which is what I'm interested in as an optimum canopy temperature for cotton. So I can look across that. There is, that graph has okra and the normal leaf plotted on each of those. And I think the most prominent effect there is that as the, and so the irrigation levels are descending. So the rain feds, the top blue line, and the 6 millimeter treatment is the bottom set. And you can clearly see that there, for both varieties, there's a very strong effect of irrigation, on the canopy temperature patterns. So you can look at that and get some idea roughly of what they look like. The next thing that's often we'll do is just reduce it to some tabular data. And there really isn't anything to see there except we take it to a tabular function. And what we can do is plot temperature differences or actual temperatures. And then along there we have mean, min, max, standard deviation, and variance. And that's a way to look at it. When we look at this one, you get a real clear picture that the temperature differences aren't very big. They're generally a good bit less than half a degree centigrade. And we've also broken those out then by the full season, early, mid, and late. So we typically break it in and look at the different periods of the season. The next thing in this one, since we're interested in a direct comparison, is we just did a pairwise t-test of all of those values to see where they are. All the red stuff is where we had significant differences. So you can see there, the two varieties did differ. And there across the top, we had the full early, mid, and late season. And then in this one, we also broke it out into a 24-hour period and then night and day to see whether things changed a lot. So you can see the differences were generally small. They were significant. They were consistent across any point in the season or any time of the day within it. And across the irrigation levels, they were still significant. The next step that I like to do a lot of times is just doing histograms or frequency distributions of the temperatures. And so this is the top panel is rain fed, the bottom panel is the high irrigation, and that's just the temperature, and on the y-axis is the frequency at which that temperature occurred. So how much of the time was spent there. The black line is the air temperature, sort of as a reference. So you can see in the rain fed, the blue and the red line, which is ochre and the normal, kind of travel pretty close together. When we do get out to the highest temperatures, you can see that the normal leaf really never experienced any temperatures over 40, but we saw a little bit of that in the ochre leaf. So under the conditions where the leaf temperatures were highest, the ochre leaf wasn't cooler. It was actually a little bit warmer in that analysis. If you go down to the bottom panel, which is the 6 millimeter, a couple of things that are useful or to see is there is this abrupt drop off in the temperature distribution that occurs right at 28, 30 degrees. And so you can see when we irrigated those, we basically shut down the occurrence of temperatures in excess of what we consider to be that optimal temperature for the cotton plant. So they're simply not there, and you can see the distribution of the air temperatures. There's a whole lot of air temperature out there that could have driven the canopy temperatures above that optimum. And that little peak right around just before that drop, that's a very characteristic thing of a fully irrigated cotton crop. And as you can see, that peak pretty much disappears when you drop water out of the equation. That's why looking at well-irrigated cotton temperatures is a boring exercise often, because they go up to about 28 or 30 and hang there. The next step that you can do, and a lot of people would do that, is to look at individual days of the data. And that's always very useful if you have something you're wanting to prove. If you have 120 diurnal temperature patterns, if you're patient enough to search through the entire 120, you're just about guaranteed to find 2 days that show exactly what you wanted it to show, regardless of what it was. And I work with a guy who will do that, take 100, 200 days of data and go, I'm looking for 5 perfect days, you know, and you pull those out. Now, that can be fair for mechanistic studies if you're wanting to ask very specific questions, but I think if you're going to take 120 days of data, you probably have to chew through it in fairness, or at least show it. And so you can see those are just patterns for 2 different days of the season. 191, which was early in the season, probably 60 days after planting, and 232, which was 100 days or more. And what you can see is you can get different patterns. You know, in the upper pattern, we have one, the normal leaf was hotter than the air. That's that red dotted line. The okra was actually cooler on that date. You can see where the 6 millimeter of the okra and normal, though, were down below air temperature and tracking one another. If you go to a different day of the year, notice now that the blue okra leaf is the one that is exceeding the air temperature, and the normal leaf is a little below that under the rain fed. But again, the characteristic in the 6mm at the bottom is you have these two lines of the okra and the normal tracking pretty closely together. But you can look at them in that format. Some regression analysis can be useful for those comparisons. And you can see there's a 0, a 1, 5, a 3, and a 6 there. And what you can pick up very clearly is how tightly clustered the data is under the rain-fed condition. They become quite similar, and then as you pull the water out, they get noisier, and the data can kind of has that little fork in it. What you see is it's kind of random variation between the okra and the normal leaf most of the time. They change positions and fluctuate a bit, but a strong irrigation effect again. This is just another picture of that. This is the difference between the normal and the okra. So it's the normal minus the okra, broken out by time of day and irrigation treatments. And you know, what you can see is the differences are small. They're generally less than half a degree. The normal leaf is a little warmer there in that one at in the rain fed, the 3 and the 6. The okra is slightly warmer at the 1.5mm. But it kind of is indicative of just how there's a lot of variation in these as you start cutting out water. The key is they do get noisy and act a little strange. There's if we look at the difference again, because we're comparing here, but it's normal minus okra. It might note that we did not do an air temperature minus CT or CT minus air. Not interested in that. Doesn't show me anything. If I did that on these, given that they all had exactly the same air temperature patterns, I'm subtracting the same number from all of them. So what I'm really looking at in that instance is just canopy temperature. So unless I'm doing a seasonal, you know, year-to-year representation or sites, looking at CT minus air doesn't get me a whole lot of information. It's just a representation of CT. What you can see there is the irrigation effect, again, very strongly. When we get to the high water, it gets very quiet. It's dry at the top, goes down, and you can see how it shifts across the season. Part of the season, one's warmer. Part of the season, the other's warmer. So that difference depends on the irrigation level and varies over the season. Another thing, another distribution frequency, that's the canopy difference between the okra and the normal, right, by the frequency of it. And what you can see there rather clearly is the 3 and the 6 are just in very tight agreement. They're really clustered around that 0. And then you see a little bit of a shift as you take the water out of the system, with the okra tending to be a little bit warmer. The distribution shifts down. And that's the 120-day data set there. So those distributions can be useful to look at. Last way we looked at this was we were interested in, the assumption was that these were going to be sensible heat exchanges that were going to be affected by the boundary layer. So we enriched the data set for conditions where the canopy temperature was greater than the air temperature. When canopy is below air temperature, sensible heat exchanges don't work. So as we look along that bottom axis, the difference there is canopy minus air. So if that number is positive, the canopy's hotter than the air. And so what that says is to the right, the sensible exchanges are enhanced. To the left of it, they're reduced. And then if we plot the canopy temperature difference between the normal and the okra, we can see where they break out. And in that analysis, what we would assume is if the okra is cooler, we would see a cluster of points in that upper right-hand quadrant. And you can see under the rain-fed condition, which is the top one, where we would expect to see the biggest enhancement, we see the cluster of points in the lower right-hand quadrant, which says that the normal leaf is actually cooler. under that condition. And then when we look at it under the rain-fed, you can see that that goes away. But sometimes it's useful in these analyses to sort of weight your environmental condition to kind of exclude or represent the data so that in this hypothesis, I'm really interested in what's going on under the conditions where the leaf shape should have the biggest effect. So there wasn't much there. What we concluded in that was that the ochre leaf was cooler than the normal under some conditions and warmer than others. Not a giant surprise to me, but no overwhelming effect. As the irrigation level increased, the two leaf types became more similar. The temperature differences were always less than about 0.5 degrees, which kind of approaches the confidence I would have in the instrument anyway. And finally, under the conditions where we would have expected the leaf shape difference to have been enhanced, we saw the opposite result from what we expected. So it wasn't even no effect, it was a reverse effect. Could have been due to all sorts of things. So very quickly, as we look at how that works, you know, these are the kind of ways that we go with our analysis. We do these season-long, throw the whole data set out there in a graphical analysis to inspect it, and you can see some things there that you're not going to see in tables of numbers. You can do the statistical analysis, the means and the mins and maxes and whatever you want, and look at that tabularly and run statistics on it, and that's very useful. The regression analysis is a good way to look for relationships. The histograms of the frequencies and the distributions can often be a very interesting way to see relationships that become very clear in that analysis that are harder to see under some other conditions. And then looking at individual days with diurnal patterns can be useful as well. So I'm going to tear through this rather quickly now. But so we can monitor it near continuous manner, seasonal time frames, using standalone infrared thermometers. Pros, continuous measurement, little in-season measurement. You can put a lot of sensors out. We've done 100 at a time. Not a very good idea, but you can do it. And these things work well, can work in production settings. They're simple and they are amenable. The cons are that there's a limited spatial coverage. Where are you going to put them and how many are you going to put out? You can get the spatial coverage up if you're willing to put out 100, but that directly leads to con number two, which is infield obstruction, and it's a nightmare having them and pulling them in and out of the field. And early season temperature measurements are kind of limited. You got to be 40 or 50 days after planting, typically, before you're going to get much information. So how could we address those cons of limited spatial infield obstruction and early season problems? So what we're wanting to do, what we want to do is field scale monitoring over time. Field scale defines the spatial aspect over time, that's the temporal. The level where we want to work is a field scale that's going to be up to 60 hectares, and we'd like to have about a meter squared resolution if we could at that point. Over time, we want to go at least a couple hundred days, and we'd like 15-minute resolution if we could get them. When we look at that, I'd say there's a spatial temporal envelope, but we have a measurement space. That's the area monitored, the sensor footprint, how big an area it's monitoring. And then you have a resolution within that footprint. And then you have, under the temporal, you have the measurement frequency and the measurement period. So how long can you measure it, and how frequently can you do it? And so I class these as two classes of sensors, fast, small footprint, and slow, large footprint. Fast is less than an hour measurement interval, let's say. Slow is something that measures at greater than 1 hour interval. Small footprint is something that's maybe less than a meter squared, and the resolution may be less than a meter squared. Large footprint, maybe greater than 10 hectares with a resolution at a meter. That's kind of where we talk. A fast, small footprint is like our smart crop or, say, a soil moisture sensor. It'll make real fast measurements continuously over a season, but it's limited to a very small footprint, right? So if you want to increase the footprint of these, you got to proliferate your sensors. Slow, large footprint, well, there's, you know, your satellite or your UAV or whatever you want to do like that, right? You can fly it up. You get a very large measurement footprint, hectares or whatever you want. The problem where you kind of get knocked on that is you got the large footprint, but you have a slow sensor. I can't fly it continuously. So it may be an hour, a day, every 2 weeks, whatever. So it's that trade-off there. So here was our design spec for the fast large footprint sensor. Measurement approximately, you know, a meter squared res, 60 hectares is a measurement area. Temporal less than an hour, maybe 100 days. Could we do that? This is what we ended up with. It took about 24 months. This is called a FIT sensor by SmartField. It's a fast large footprint sensor. On the top of that is a thermal imaging system and video system, and then it's mounted on a head that's computer controlled to scan and raster the field. And so that thing can raster a 100-acre field in about 10, 15 seconds, and it'll do that all season long. So we have that out. There's kind of a picture of those are some of the images that it would get, showing, you know, if I wanted to cover that field with individual sensors, it would take that, and then if I wanted to replicate them and then duplicate them, pretty soon I got thousands of sensors in the field to get an image that doesn't really improve on what I've got here. Okay, it keeps going and going and going. There you go. The bottom line is thousands of collection points, 96 times a day, all season long. And the way you do it is you virtualize sensors. So you pick a geo space in the field. Since the sensor doesn't move, everything stays the same. And you just monitor it over and over and over. So there's that sensor. We've now got a next gen of it, which is a smaller, lower resolution, a good bit cheaper, that's been designed really to put into production systems. So we think that is I think that instrumentation will continue to improve and that we may be at the point where we've got technology that will allow us to do field scale stuff. Is the cost a problem? I don't know. Cost is going to be related to the value that it produces for the producer. Instrument costs and stuff go down all the time. Data interpretation is what you end up paying for. Analytics and algorithms, those are always going to be a problem. We're collecting about 30 billion measurements a year. Can't put them into an Excel sheet. Private sector people, or our efforts are a little lagging and reduced on this. Public sector is. Private sector, they've got money and equipment and smart people, and they're moving real fast on those kind of analytics. Bang, that's it. Thank you for your time. Do I have time for a question?
Yeah, we've got time for a couple of questions.
Yeah. You would see it. You'll see it. Under certain conditions. Now, you know, the problem is, I don't know, we don't see a lot. We tend to see these extremes, right? Our well-irrigated stuff never really goes to the high temperatures because of the way we manage our studies over the last few years. I'm sure it occurs. I'm sure you could associate it with temperature. Mick shook his head yes, because he lives in the world of fruit shed. But what we find is that if you give them you got sufficient water, we don't see a lot of, we see canopy temperatures that are relatively stable so much of the time. And then under drought stress conditions, that gets noisy. But it might, I don't know whether it's useful, whether you can predict with it or not. Well, the difficulty with those is that we can increase the footprint of them, but the temporal resolution goes to pot, and it's you can't get simultaneous measurements. So if I drive through a field and it takes me an hour, I'm getting this one at 12 o'clock and I'm getting this one at 1 o'clock. And so the advantage of the fixed sensor that's fast with a large footprint is you get lots of simultaneous measurements. You see everything at the same condition. So comparisons across the area can be good.
So with these high throughput phenotyping platform tracker base, and then take an hour to run the field, it makes sense to track it and compare.
And it depends what you're trying to see. Right, it's the time scale of what it is. If you're measuring plant height, you know, you can measure plant height with a slow sensor, it won't be any problem.
And who's going to be the primary user of this technology?
Well, we think that ultimately it'll go the way they're moving it is to production systems. The trick is people aren't interested in canopy temperature. What they're interested is binary solutions derived from the temperature, right? You're ahead or you're behind on your irrigation. You've got an infestation of a bug here versus there. You've got a light stand here versus there. That's the kind of information they want. And just gazing at the temperature data becomes kind of mesmerizing. It makes lots of pretty pictures. But it depends what you're trying to manage. You could put soil moisture sensors in there. Some people like that, you know, as something to fall back on and to help interpret. So you could. It's easy enough to incorporate them because once you have a data collection system, you could you can easily feed in infield sensors or UAV data or anything like that that would be useful.
You're welcome.